Hi, and welcome to Do La La, the podcast.
With me, Leanne from Birthhood, and Meg from Birth Evolution. We are both birth and postnatal doulas with over 12 years' experience supporting people through pregnancy, birth, and the postnatal period.
In this podcast, we'll be taking a deep dive into birth in a relaxed and informal space, bringing you knowledge, experience, and tips in a way that supports you, whether you are pregnant, working in the birth world, or just a birth nerd like us.
We'll be leaving no stone unturned with our unfiltered approach to conversation about birth and can't wait for you to join us.
All opinions are, of course, our own, and our experiences and discussions in no way constitute medical advice.
Hello and welcome back to the Do La La podcast with me, Meg from Birth Evolution.
And me, Leanne.
You remembered you're here.
I am friends.
We are really excited today because we've got a guest episode with somebody very close to mine and Leanne's hearts. We've known her for a very long time, and she's here to give all her knowledge and experience about a topic that we're all really, really passionate that people should know about. And I'm going to get this one in straight away, even if you think at this point in time you don't think you should know about it. So we are here with the lovely Anna from Hackney Hypnobirthing. Hello, Anna.
Hello. Yay. Very nice to be here.
So nice to have you here. First of all, let's just get started with who you are, story of your life. So who are you? What is it that you do?
So hi everybody, hello you two. I am Anna Clarkson and I am a hypnobirthing teacher, antenatal teacher. I also teach baby massage, but I teach in Hackney, East London, and my business name is Hackney Hypnobirthing, because...
So creative.
Three letters for you, Meg, SEO. Should people Google hypnobirthing in Hackney, hopefully I might come up, aside from all those, am I allowed to swear, bloody Google adverts that come up from other various...
But you are not, you do also teach to the world rather than just Hackney.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I thought that'd be incredibly limited because I started teaching in lockdown. So only on Zoom was the first thing. And I thought, oh God, actually, is this going to be a real problem? But no, I do. I haven't taught that many people overseas recently, but I can teach people who are a lot further away than East London on Zoom, which I'm still doing. Not as much, but every couple of months. And it's, I really enjoy it. It's great.
Where's the furthest you've taught, Anna, on Zoom?
Ecuador. Probably the furthest. Lots in Europe, Canada, North America. I think Ecuador's probably the first, and a little bit for my sister in Australia, not masses, but that was a lot more informal, obviously.
You're just global.
Yeah,
I can't stop singing Ecuador now. Yeah. Thanks for that.
Very high cesarean rates, actually. So so they specifically were a cesarean course couple, those two.
Okay, so. Okay. Mm. Which brings us to, and I'm going to say this again, this session, we're in a hypnobirthing course. This episode of the Do La La podcast is going to talk a lot about cesarean, but do not switch off if you are in no way contemplating, hoping for, or planning to have a cesarean birth at all, because we are all really, really passionate about the fact that knowing about what we're about to talk about is so deeply essential for everybody who is pregnant and preparing for birth, regardless of what your birth intentions are. I cannot say that more. Yep. And the other girls are nodding as well. So do not switch off. If you are vigorously nodding, do not switch off if cesarean is not something that you are even allowing yourself to think about. In fact, actively listen on if you are consciously trying to avoid even thinking about it, because this might really make a massive difference to you.
Completely.
I think as doulas and antenatal teachers, I think what I get a lot of, I don't understand it. Why do you get your clients to plan a cesarean birth if they are not wanting a cesarean birth? And I think for me, this is probably the perfect place to start, really, in terms of why do you, like, my clients probably get on board with that because they understand it quite quickly. But generally speaking, why would we expect anybody to plan a birth that they are not hoping for, such as cesarean?
Yeah, you. So I think we all agree that you should plan for the birth you want and for the birth that you don't want. Because, well, there's lots of reasons, complicated reasons, but not least because you can't control birth and anything can happen. But let me just give you some statistics, which I was just noting down on a post-it note.
So clever. It's not in your head?
They are almost in my head. So the national maternity statistics for 22-23 were released, I want to say December, I think it was, the end of last year anyway. And according to that, you have 43% chance of going to spontaneous labour. 23% of those people were having a planned cesarean. 33% were having an induction. 39% of pregnancies ended in a cesarean.
That's massive, isn't it?
So 39% of all pregnancies, is this just UK?
Just UK.
Yeah, end in cesarean. And is that so-called unplanned or emergency? Is that all? So 39% of all births end in some form of cesarean.
So 23% of them were planned, but then 39% ended up being with cesarean. So yes, there absolutely are unplanned cesareans in there as well. Yeah, definitely. And if you're looking at the statistic around 33% of inductions, then you know it doesn't take a huge leap of faith to see where that is. And not that every induction ends in cesarean, please, you know, that's absolutely not the case. But we are intervening at incredibly high rates, and it's just really important that you have this in your plan. And even if, you know, I have examples of people who have planned home birth that goes to a, you know, that's the most extreme, I suppose, to an unplanned cesarean. And they are bloody glad that they have got a really solid plan, because what you don't know, you don't know. And actually, there are so many things that you can plan to make it an individualized, positive, really beautiful experience. So don't get me wrong, there can be disappointment in that as well, of course. But I think when people feel that they have some, retain some level of autonomy, that makes a big difference to how they feel.
And just with that statistics, what was the, and I'm asking you guys because I can't quite remember it, the, is it the World Health Organization does have an expectation of what a
10 to 15%.
So for a given country, around 10 to 15% cesarean should be about expected or normal, exactly, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now that doesn't account for maternal preference, which I think is also really important. You know, if someone wants to choose to do that, that's and should absolutely be supported to do that. And I think that's important as well. But yeah, it's a lot higher. There is no hospital in England I am aware of that's reporting less than 30%. No. I mean, there's quite a few in London that are above 50%. And some of those are skewed because they have complicated pregnancies, and you know, so there is stuff within there that, but still, it's big numbers. So you've got to be prepared and ready. And it's a big bit of my course, and I'm sure yours as well. I don't regret that at all. I think that's so important.
So you've mentioned I think you mentioned choices in there and planning. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a very big question and will lead us through loads of different areas of thinking. But what is there to choose? Because a lot of people, I imagine, would assume if they are, let's think about an unplanned particularly. Mm. Well, surely if I need a cesarean, then it's just going to be done to me. Everything else is out of the window. I'm going to be taken into theatre. There's probably all sorts of impressions from TV and what we expect that to look like. I think a good place to start would be, what are we even talking about here in terms of options and choices that a given person might have when it comes to something like a cesarean?
Yeah. So I just want to quickly touch on the word that you used there, which I think is really important, because most people talk about emergency cesarean, and you're absolutely right to that. That's not correct. Really, most of the time we mean unplanned, as you've said. Because now this is from the Sentinel report of 2011, which I wish they would update. It would be great to see the stats from this, but we take the data from there. That 2% of births overall are true emergency. Get this baby out. Category one, general anaesthetic. Super fast. 8% of cesareans are that. The vast majority fall within unplanned, will be in category 2 or 3, and then planned is category 4. But that's an important semantic I just want to mention, because the way the NHS defines it as planned or elective and emergency, rather than what would be more accurate.
So categories 2 and 3 are also defined from an NHS perspective as emergency.
Sometimes three can be planned as well, but generally speaking, yes, they fall within those two and three brackets, exactly. So
I think that's absurd, though, just to, like, because obviously this is what I go through as well with clients, but I think if you speak, the amount of people you speak to, and it is very deep into that societal conditioning, is that every person that has an unplanned cesarean, unless they are informed, unless they've done kind of some education, will come out saying they had an emergency. Mm-hmm. And I find it really heartbreaking. Do you know when you break it down and then they say, well, yeah, a baby was distressed, so we had an emergency. And then they talk about, then it's like an hour before they go to theatre or waiting for a spot in theatre, blah, 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 blah. And you go, and it's really hard, isn't it, for us to sit there and go, like, you can't put it on them that you're changing the language, that wasn't an emergency. Mm-hmm. But equally, that narrative needs to really shift, doesn't it? So people can come away with a different experience and feeling of that birth.
Yeah, that word, I mean, that it's emerged that a cesarean became necessary. This is slightly off topic. God, as if we would ever go off topic. but I do, on that point, for anyone who is pregnant listening to this, and I'm assuming people who are pregnant, generally speaking, I would strongly urge you to look at Kirsten Small. Put up her name into your podcast app. She's got an amazing episode of The Great Birth Rebellion, because 99% of the time where a baby was indicated to be in distress because of CTG monitoring, when they look at the cord gases afterwards, they weren't. Now, that is going to be a really difficult thing for people to hear.
I literally had that conversation today. I was with doula clients this morning. We were talking about it. She couldn't believe it. So I brought the study up and I showed her. And she was like, because I said, I found this absolutely shocking. How can that be the case? And she was like, gosh, how many decisions are made then based on that CTG monitoring for example, an unplanned cesarean? And I'm like, exactly. This is why being informed is best. That's a really good episode.
And that's why our cesarean rates are... through the roof, because so much decision making from their perspective is based on this magic evidence that isn't quite.
Absolute shocker. It really increases your chance for cesarean. I really urge anybody to be very, very, be thinking very carefully about CTG. Let's just put it that way. But that's probably
another podcast. I'm going to make a list here of all the episodes that we're going to get in. Whole episode on CTG.
Sarah Wick has got an amazing post about that particular study. I think it's Politi and et al. That was the study that I think it came out maybe 2021, something like that. Anyway, that was
2023, I think.
Very good. Yeah. Right. So, anyway, crazy. But back to what was the original question?
Choices. So basically, what is for people who think that maybe that, well, surely there's no choice at this point. This is as medical as it gets. What is there?
There's loads of different things that you can consider. Seemingly, seem very, very small, but could actually really add up to a lot. So. Things like, now I have to say, generally speaking, the feedback I get when people go into theatre for an unplanned cesarean, or, you know, and planned as well, is that the people in that room are so kind, so supportive. They are so aware that this is not an environment that you would normally be in and want to make it as calm and as the best that it could possibly be for you. So that, for number one, I will just say that. One of the first things, honestly, could be that the people in that room, because there's a lot, it's very unlikely there'll be fewer than seven people in the room, members of staff, and I can go through that in a second. But each of those saying, oh, hi, I'm Bob, and this is my job, this is what I do. And, you know, so just to kind of know what's happening, I think that can be really helpful, that then you sort of put yourself onto like an even playing field, and remembering that ultimately you are at the top of that hierarchy, by the way, as a person in labour. In pregnancy. So I think number one, sort of setting that, we would like you, this is all choices, by the way. This is not that everybody has to do any of these things, but this is something you could consider. Okay, could everyone in the room tell me who they are? I would like to have my own music in room. You know, theatres, by their very nature, operating theatres are, you know, medicalised, sterile environment. Of course they are. So how might you make that a little bit more personalised? So having your own music as you go in. something seemingly, you know, could feel so tiny is rather than being wheeled in on a wheelchair or on a gurney, walking into theatre. Now, of course, there are going to be situations if someone has already had an epidural sited and they simply are not able to do that. Of course, there's going to be circumstances. But that can also feel like, you know, I am going in there, my head held high, and I'm really excited because I'm about to meet my baby. You know, that could really change the dynamic for you. So you're in. And then you could take, if you have been using a particular scent as a kind of grounding hypnobirthing tool, you could have that for you sort of on a cloth.
In what format? Yeah, because I think that's often something that people would struggle to get on board with, that would something they would be able to have. So in what form would you suggest people had a scent? Or what form do you know people have used and it's been acceptable to theatre staff?
So the vast majority, to be honest with you, had a kind of a little essential oils rollable. And I've got a picture of one of them, in fact, as she's having her anaesthetic cited, which she was very concerned about. Now, to be fair, actually, that was a planned cesarean, one example. So she was sitting and just sniffing that, and it was really helping her to just remain as calm as possible. But I have had a scenario where it was an unplanned cesarean where the midwife was literally running down the corridor with this to give to her. And I found that incredibly moving that she had noticed that this had been important to her, and then she would then had it at that point. But you can absolutely have, you know, a pillow spray on a cloth or something, taking that in and then just having that on the bed next to your head or whatever, or your partner could have it, or, you know, I suppose your partner could also have it on their wrists as well, you know, because they're going to be on the left hand side of your head. You know, just being able to kind of, you know, having them close in that way. Scent triggers are so important to us, we know that,
so
from
important
a perspective.
Do you know,
so
I actually
helpful
go on I was just gonna say I actually had a client who was having a planned cesarean whose midwife, we were talking about this, and one of her choices was she'd been using aromatherapy through pregnancy, and she was like, I've got my rollerball that my doula's given me and I'm going to take that in. They were like, oh no, because it's a clinical sterile environment, you can't take that in. And I was like, no, that's a lie, you absolutely can take that in. I said, if you look behind that room, there's this Bluetooth speaker, there's a all these people, that none of those are sterile. It's like, as long as you're not putting that rollerball in the incision, you can have that with you. So she went back to her midwife and said that, and she was like, well, that's the information that I've got. And I said, and I just said, well, maybe, I said to her, I was like, maybe you need to consider what information you are sharing. If you not don't know that it's factually correct, don't share it.
Yeah.
Like, ultimately. So, yeah, on that note,
oh, I hear stuff like
that
this all the time.
Yeah. All the time. Yeah. The music thing is
always ask questions. Yeah.
Always. Yeah, always. And people would never assume they could have music in there. But, I've been in cesareans as a doula, where they've been like, right, what's your Spotify password? Have you got it on a USB? Like, what's your... We've got a computer. Mm. Yeah, they have devices in there that you literally can put whatever you want. I've also had a client who has said that they tried to get her to remember her Spotify password as they were putting the spinal in, which she's just like, I don't know.
Is that a distraction technique?
I don't, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah.
Tops all of them. Okay, so what? So we've got...
to that point,
everyone choose themselves, music, go on.
So I was just going to say, just to that point though, actually, something you could do, so A, perhaps asking that question, how does your music work within here? If you have Spotify, could you potentially put your Spotify details on your birth plan? So then, and it's a partner job, isn't it, ultimately? So that they could at least, you know, go through those things and just make that more simple. So I hadn't actually thought about that before. It's different listeners have different formats, but...
Oh my God, that's a massive top tip there, Anna. Thank you for that, because I hadn't thought about that either.
Thanks very much, on the fly. Now these might seem really small, but these can make a big, big difference. So one of the really key things I think people, and this is sort of skipping ahead, but I'll explain why. Afterwards, having skin-to-skin contact with your baby, unless your baby is in extreme distress and needs to be taken away to have a take a look at, immediate skin to skin is defined as within 10 minutes, by the way. So though, if there is a delay, if they come back to your chest within 10 minutes, that is still defined as that immediate skin to skin. So what can aid that is not having a load of stuff all over the place. So number one, you can put your gown on back to front, so that, which, you know, in the UK they do up at the back. In America sometimes they've got poppers on, which would be so much easier. But if you had that on back to front rather than conventionally, then you would be able to open that up and then your baby could immediately come to your chest. Or have one shoulder out so then you could bring your gown down. So when we mean skin to skin, we mean your baby's bare skin against your bare chest, essentially. Mm-hmm. There isn't a lot of room. Sometimes it can feel like you end up wearing your baby a bit like a scarf, you know, because they're so high up on your chest, which can be quite intense. But that can help smooth that transition out. And having the ECG dot monitors things like on the shoulder and ribs instead of all over your chest. Having a finger pulse monitor placed on your toe so you've got greater movement with your hands. Having your cannula, which is for fluids and antibiotics, placed in your non-dominant hand. So I'm left-handed, I'd have my right. And that would just, again, just eases movement. And all of these little things you think, oh God, who cares? That doesn't matter. That can make a big difference in the moment of just creating as much ease as possible. So
it's not even necessarily in the moment. It's not always just about the fact that your cannula is in the non-dominant hand and your ECG dots are away from your chest. But the process of making those requests, the process of knowing that would suit you and actually documenting that and communicating that to somebody else just gives you this sense of greater power. There's so much about that process, in a way, more powerful than actually getting the stuff you're requesting in the first place. Because you're going in there like, I had a say in this.
Yes. Yeah, and do you know what? You take those skills beyond. So obviously I had my operation last week for my breast surgery. I had a lump in my breast. It's benign, like no one needs to worry. But they were like, because it was in my left breast, they were like, we want to cannula in your right. And I was like, well, I'm right-handed, so actually my preference is you do it in the left. And they're like, we prefer not to. And I was like, but I'd prefer you to. And they also said about where I put their ECGs. And she was like, and I said, well, just put them out of the way, like put them on back. And even like when they said to me about the gown, I was like, you're operating on my breast, like makes more sense to put it on backwards. But again, it sounds silly, but it's not. Those skills... I had my rollerball going down to theatre.
Amazing.
Just because I know that it was skills that I obviously share, but equally I know it has the impact. And I was like chilled as anything. It was beautiful. Like beautiful. I was having a lump removed from my breast, but you know what I mean. Like, I'm not going to fantasize about that.
You're making the best of, of a situation, right? You know, you're absolutely right, having some level of autonomy and actually just going through that process of talking to your partner, whoever that is who's supporting you in the room in that moment. And this is what I would like to happen. You know, it's not the be all and end all, but it is, I think it can, like you say, just feel like you're just addressing what you can think about going into that room. Another thing that I think can be helpful, so back to the point, if your baby does need a bit of help breathing, which can happen after a cesarean, because they're not getting that squeezing through the birth path, that sometimes it's literally turning them over and actually not upside down by the feet, I mean turning them horizontally and manually removing that stuff, sometimes that does everything that they need to do. But if they do need to be placed on the resuscitator with paediatricians in the room or whoever else, that you could have the resuscitator placed in your eye line, because a theatre can fit. You can sometimes. So a friend of mine was telling me that happened with her daughter. This was years ago. And she felt like she was miles away from her. And actually for her partner as well, it's like, he wanted to be with me, but he wanted to be with the baby. And there was this awful tug of war. So that can be very helpful for partners as well to just not have to make that kind of sort of momentarily agonizing decision, to just eases that in that moment.
I think that definitely needs recording.
Say that again.
I think that definitely needs recording on your plan, because otherwise they will instinctively take them to the side, and it's kind of said in a way to protect you so you don't see something it can be quite triggering, but equally having no view of that, you've got it's your choice again. It comes down to that.
And again, all of these things, none of these are prerequisite to feel good about your birth, by the way. Everyone's things are going to be different, everyone's preferences, whatever, but these are little things that I certainly know have added up to a lot for the people that I have taught. Just I'm thinking back in terms of sort of hypnobirthing triggers here as well. So actually going back in time before you actually go in, if there is this gap in between, whether it's planned or unplanned, or this the wait before, listening to affirmations, listening to positive, you know, recordings, or, you know, you could also do a bit of light touch massage. Very clearly in theatre, you're not going to have back access. Let's be clear about that. But you could potentially change that to arm or hand, so that you're adjusting that massage technique that perhaps you've practiced in pregnancy. I mean, these are hypnobirthing techniques, of course.
Yeah.
So that can be really comforting to just have that touch. You know, so often people will say that they've actually got two, that they feel like they're the only people in that room in spite of having all those members of staff there, you know.
Can I just add something there? Because through kind of some of the work that I've done personally, we've looked at some techniques called havening, which is basically like it's to do with touch. So havening is something where you basically rub your hands together. I'm doing it now, but you can't see me. And at the same time, you would be having a conversation with somebody, completely distracting you from the scenario that you're in. So this is really good like something like a cesarean, something like that. And the reason is we have receptors in our hand which trigger our nervous system to relax and switch off.
Mm-hmm.
So things like, you know, like we have therapy dogs, don't we? And like we mm-hmm. stroke them. One of the reasons mm-hmm. we have that is because it releases, it triggers our central nervous system to kind of soothe us. And it is, but it takes around 10 minutes for that kind of process to actually work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could do that for yourself. So you could be like talking, singing, whatever, having a fun. Mm-hmm. But equally, you as a partner, we need to remember that they're in that situation as well. So you can like hug yourself and do this. And a partner could do that before they go in to keep themselves regulated.
Mm-hmm.
In theatre, your partner doing this sort of massage where they're stroking mm-hmm. down their hand, that's actually regulating them as well, because they're mm-hmm. in that situation and observing and things. Yeah. So that's mm-hmm. a technique that I'm like now starting to pass on more, because actually I realised how I found it useful to regulate myself. God, how useful is it going to be for people going to a situation they've never been in before that they feel a bit scared about?
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about massage and touch in hypnobirthing. So when I learned this, I was like, this makes complete sense. Like,
total
why wouldn't...
Yeah.
Like, I understand now more why the partner gets regulated, because of the receptors in the hand. So I heard it, but you know, now you have like that massive like light bulb.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that. I've never heard of that it was called that before, but often where a arm massage is just happens naturally anyway, and you often see people doing that anyway as they're talking to you, doing that with their hands. So we're all doing it now.
It's self-regulate, it's just self-regulation. But
I think people do it.
I could do that
a lot. You see a lot of people, I'm touch my face a lot, and I think that's part of that as well. You see people running their hands around the back of their neck and things. You just think it's these little twitches and these little things that we have, and actually they're so deeply ingrained for such deeper reasons than just I'm a fiddler or I'm a fidget. Yeah.
Oh,
I think
no
that
question. Makes a massive difference. Yeah. We do loads of stuff like that. That is so, it's so primal, you know, like touch is
so
such
primal.
Such an important thing for us.
Okay. So, you've mentioned loads of incredible things that you can request. Out of curiosity, in your experience, where does planned versus unplanned, particularly if there's an emergency, a genuine emergency scenario, much of this may not apply, or some of this may not apply, because we're talking about timescales, right, in terms of whether you've got time for these conversations. Now, a lot of that then is why we'd say have this stuff planned, have this stuff documented as in advance as possible, so it doesn't require a long conversation.
Yes.
But some of this, it will depend on this scenario leading to the cesarean in the first place.
So, well, I think you said it really. So when I get people to make their cesarean plans, even if they're seemingly quite resistant to it, and not necessarily turning loads and loads of attention to it, I have to say. I haven't had that many examples where it's been a real true emergency, I have to say.
Yeah.
The fact that if you write it, even if you never want to look at it again, write it and make three copies, one that goes in your bag, one that your partner has, and one that is then handed to the registrar, whoever is in the room who is doing that you hand it over. And maybe you make it sort of like your bullet points at the top of the thing that are, okay, these are the really key things for me. I really want skin to skin with my baby as soon as possible afterwards. You know, I would like to have freedom of movement, cannulate, whichever hand it is, you know. Make it so easy for them to read in that way, that the things that really are your top priorities. And I generally see that that is honoured as much as possible. Especially around delayed and optimal clamping as well. And we are learning so much more about
that. I was just about to say that, because we encourage people to be autonomous and advocate. And in a theatre scenario, the time before clamping, I think, is the one thing that is usually this is the way we do it. This is the way we do it. And I see so little movement for people when they make certain requests. Mm. Would you agree?
And actually, I was talking to someone fairly recently and she had a doula who also happens to be a friend of ours. And she was sat in the room with a consultant who literally said, we can't clamp longer than a minute, because what am I going to say? Because the blood goes back into
the placenta.
Oh, yeah, it's ridiculous. There's no evidence.
The doula, it's bollocks, by the way, for anyone questioning that. And the doula just sat there shaking her head. And so our client turned around and said, have you ever heard of that before? To which the doula was just like, no, I haven't. No. And not one single other medic in that room questioned that. Yeah, that is... you're going to have to probably push quite hard on it. I have to say, my local hospital are getting a lot better at it, because we do know how important this is for them to receive the ever-growing body of evidence to have the platelets and the hemoglobin and iron stores and everything else that goes along with...
Podcast episode!
Yeah, it's absolutely an episode in itself. I do think you're right. I think it can be just, this is how it is. And I think, to be honest with you, this is birth partner jobs. I'm really sorry, but it is.
Yeah, and I hate having to walk, because when we go through this in my courses, and I will warn people, say, look, there are some of these things on this list. You are, honestly, the chances of you getting them are really slim. But there's a wonderful doula who, I was their doula when they had a planned caesarean birth, and they had basically three non-negotiables, absolute non-negotiables. Amazing. There was the benefit of the fact it was planned, because there were meetings with consultants in advance, and it was almost like, we are all preparing for this. So there was definitely that greater benefit of time.
Yes.
But the three non-negotiables were that when the baby was brought out through the incision, everybody was to be completely silent, and the first voice the baby was to hear was hers. I get amazing. Really, really teary when I talk about it.
Yeah.
Which to me just shows how wonderful a caesarean birth can be. I can get just as emotional about caesareans as any other birth.
Goosebumps.
That she literally, the consultant at the point the head was going to be brought out, said, right, everybody, stop talking now. The head is coming out, move the head out. And then said, right, almost pointed at my client, said, and the baby made a noise, she spoke. It just is, it gives me tingles. So that was number one, and it was honoured beautifully. Yes, there was advanced planning, but I don't see why that couldn't be communicated in a can everybody hush up. That's not difficult. The second one was keeping the placenta attached.
Yes.
And it was kept attached for 61 minutes. Amazing. She was in recovery. And I'm not suggesting to anybody listening to this that was an easy thing to advocate for, and you are going to be able to get that from a conversation quickly with a consultant. You're not. It just goes to show that lifting out a baby, not cutting the cord, and putting the placenta in a bowl on a chair next to somebody's head, it is not difficult. It's not normal. And it's not common. And it's an additional thought process for theatre staff.
Yeah.
But it really isn't. It's not dangerous. It's not difficult to do.
No.
But I'll eat my hat if the vast majority of people ever manage to achieve that. Speaking of which, her third non-negotiable was hat.
This is a podcast
episode in itself. Now, we definitely need to present that for healthy full-term babies. Evidence is not that a hat is required, that we just don't need to put a hat on a healthy full-term baby. Now, I guess in a theatre perspective, there's that question of, are we dealing with a healthy baby potentially because of the reasons why that caesarean might be necessary? But ultimately, it is the birthing person's choice whether that baby has a hat on. But in my experience, theatres are practically riddled with hat police.
I was going to say, don't take one in.
If that hat ever goes away from that head, people rush to grab it back on. Mm-hmm. But she was very insistent. But as another option, I mean, again, the chances of you having that supported because you've got seven people all trying to get the hat on the baby's head. Yeah.
Well, don't take a hat in for a start. That sort of
they all have them, though. They have their own.
They can do. Yeah, I think, you know, and then, or I just don't want your stuff that's been hanging around in theatre, thank you very much, on my baby's head. So I think if you don't have one there, I think it can at least make that slightly easier. But no, you're right. I think it's very, very standard, isn't it? Just to come back to your point about the 61 minutes, you know, I have known lotus birth to be facilitated for a cesarean. So if you can do that, then you can damn well wait for 5, 10, 15, 20, however long, you know, in the time. So in terms of
and
that,
do we, in the same way we might say to somebody, prepare for a, put down that you're preparing for a home birth, even if you're not intending to. That's another episode. Yes. Is perhaps just tell them you're having a lotus birth.
Yeah, and absolutely.
That's your intention.
So one of my clients recently told everyone, she was a home birth client, but she said, yeah, I'm having a lotus birth. No intention of having a lotus birth at all. But just in case anyone was going to get a little bit excited with a pair of scissors, no, thank you. No, thank you. Step away. So that definitely was part of the thing. An insurance policy, for sure.
For the benefit of listeners, a lotus birth is where you do not cut the cord at all. And so the only separation from baby and the placenta is the point at which the cord separates and moves away from the actual belly button on the baby.
The other thing we haven't mentioned, and it's not that common in the UK, I have to say at the moment, is maternal assisted cesarean. So the person to follow, if you want to know more about this, and I have to, it's not for everyone, I do accept that, i.e. not everyone will want to do this, is for, so Dr. Natalie Elphinstone is a most incredible Australian obstetrician, and she's just fantastic to follow anyway. Yeah, she's amazing. Fascinating. And so this is what it sounds like, somebody reaching over the screen. They'll be wearing gloves because beyond the screen is sterile, right? That's how they define it within theatre. With gloves to help to bring their baby up and out. And also paternal assisted. So I mean, I realise that not all partners are dads, but, you know, that's the definition that they use, to help to deliver the baby out. Now, that's not what everybody wants to do, but I think the fact that it can be done in other countries, and I think I've heard it being done at Nottingham. I very rarely haven't heard any in my local hospital yet. But I
no way up here either. No chance.
So maybe it's going to become more of a thing, but that's an amazing thing, isn't it? And you know, that probably requires a bit more conversation and easier, perhaps, arguably, with a planned cesarean. But
just the fact that not for everybody. Of course it's not. A lotus birth isn't for everybody. Having the screen lowered isn't for everybody. None of this conversation is that anybody has to do any of this stuff.
No, precisely.
But the fact that choice is there. Totally.
Yeah.
That none of this just goes without saying, and you're having a cesarean, so off we go.
Yes,
and that's the beauty of all of this.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
I think what a lot of people do in terms of, like, I hate the word compromise because it should always be your decision, but a compromise from a maternal assisted cesarean, it's often more of a gentle cesarean.
The umbrella term, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have more of a natural expulsion from the uterus via a cesarean birth, which you can watch. So it's not maternal assisted in terms of the mum brings the baby out or the birthing person brings the baby out, but instead, you are part of that process by watching and knowing that baby's having a more of a gentle birth, which lots of trusts are getting better at, but it's still not the norm, is it?
No, I think it is becoming better. I have to live in a stage of positivity and optimism about this stuff.
I was going to say inertia. Inertia?
And that too, frequently. Yeah. to mention that slower birth as well, so where a baby is almost like what they call walking out, that they might be able to come out by themselves, is what they're trying to mimic there is that squeezing action on the lungs to try and get rid of some of those fluids so that they're emerging more slowly. And sometimes encouraged to actually try and squeeze your muscles. Now, that is hard when you're anaesthetized from the chest downwards, don't get me wrong, but if you put your hands onto your chest, you could actually feel your muscles moving in that way. that's the umbrella term. People often ask me, what do we mean by gentle cesarean? And, you know, there are absolutely factions in the birth world who are like, there's no such thing. You can't have those words together. It's like, fuck you. Like, I'm so sorry. But that's just, it's so, I don't know. I just think we can have, there is space to have beauty in all of these different birth scenarios.
And it's for that person who experiences it. If I don't, if I have not had a cesarean, but let's, if I'd had a cesarean, and I was absolutely hell-bent that it was not natural and I did not feel that was a natural process and that was how I labelled my experience, then that is all that matters. But likewise, if I felt I'd made all of these requests and I'd had these things honoured and that made for me the most natural, beautiful cesarean I could have had, and that's how I want to label it, absolutely fine. Yeah. It's not for anybody else to make that statement.
No, it's not.
No.
On behalf of somebody else, which is why language, and actually remaining quite neutral about language unless you know where somebody's preferences lie... is really, really important. I saw, I can't even remember because I scroll and scroll and scroll and then see something and can't find it again. There was a conversation about, you guys might have seen it, around people not using the word section.
Yes.
Not using the word cesarean section. It was about people actually being really frustrated with using the term belly birth.
Yes, I've saw
because a lot of people say belly birth as an alternative to abdominal birth or an alternative to cesarean birth, and some people saying they hated it, and absolutely, completely validly saying why they thought it was a horrible term and why they were happy to use cesarean section and why they didn't mind the clinical clinical language, which is absolutely fine as well. And it's really what you feel, and you might not work that out until afterwards.
No, and you just mirror the language of the person who's going through that experience. That's the most important 100%. Thing. I have to say, I've never used belly birth or abdominal birth. I don't use either of those. I tend to use cesarean birth in the literature within my course. So I should say I have a specific cesarean course. I think you guys do as well, actually. So, and the reason that came about, by the way, is not because I've had cesareans and I'm super passionate about them. And that was not, certainly when I started, that wasn't the thing. It came about, as so many things in my life, by accident, because I was teaching someone to hypnobirthing on the day we were about to start. Said she was, had been so busy, and I got the enrollment form the day we were starting. And she said, oh, I'm having a planned cesarean, to which I was like, shit, and had to get up to speed because there was just so much that was not relevant. And so I effectively wrote a course around her, and because we were kind of mates, I could do that and learning on the go. And so, and in that time, I've become really passionate that we are, you know, that we can celebrate this birth and make the very best of what can be, you know, absolutely the right birth for some people, you know, and also not what people's first choice, you know, that's true, that too. So,
and you said this before as well, that you can plan for this and you can prepare for this and you can have loads of options and choices and still be fucking hateful of the fact that that experience happened to you. You can grieve. You know, you can be in control and grieve it at the same time. There's no exact way or exact combination of emotions through any of this. Any of this to do with birth. You get to make that choice over how do you feel about it.
That's totally. We are complex mammals, you know, we can hold lots of different thoughts at the same time, for sure. And, you know, I'm about to share it soon. I've had a load of stories to share and just had a complete backlog and not released them. But one of that's coming soon is someone who was planning. So she had a cesarean the first time, unplanned, planning a VBAC. And actually, that didn't work out, and then ended with a second elective cesarean. Oh, I say elective, but, you know, actually second unplanned, really, would be probably the best way to describe it. And, you know, she said, but, you know, the first time I really didn't know what my choices are. This time I really did. And actually, you know what? I felt that that was good. But I'm sure there will be people who will see that and think, oh, you know, that must be so disappointing. And of course that does exist, but ultimately she feels pretty good about it. So there are so many, it's you know, myriad feelings and thoughts around that. And equally, people who really don't want that and then end up with it and then do feel incredibly down and disappointed about it. But you move through emotion, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot to contend with. That's so much of a ramble.
Ultimately, no, it's amazing. I think this is ultimately why, that going back to that first point we made in terms of like, why do you plan for it, is the fact that birth isn't linear. Birth is one of the things that we can have, we can do everything to prepare for physiological birth, but we need to remember we've got an entity inside us that might have different say in it, and therefore birth sometimes does end up in a, even with all the best preparation in the world, doing all the things, hiring a doula, whatever it is, it might all end up like that for whatever reason. And if you've done that preparation and planned for that scenario, you like as Meg, you said, you can still be disappointed and grieve the birth that you wanted, but you can come away thinking, well, at least I made these decisions and at least I had control of some of these elements so that I didn't go, it was unplanned and I just relinquished all control and I come away feel completely traumatised because I hadn't thought about this. And it's in it is that autonomy, isn't it? And that's what we, I suppose, as antenatal, hypnobirthing and teachers, doulas, whatever, we are, it's what we're doing is helping our clients have autonomy.
Totally, yeah.
That's it.
Something, there was something a while ago about it was probably Deb's Niger, because I just love everything that she posts. But there was about how birth planning is trying to avoid birth trauma, and I think that is it in a nutshell. To be honest with you, when people dismiss birth plans, and we all wang about this all the time, they don't know what they're talking about actually, because it's the perception that you are in some way going to have control. I do see the theory that if you don't plan anything, then how could you you can never be disappointed. But for me, I don't think that's a great idea. But obviously, each of them.
Really, in our experience, in our line of work, do we come across people who have not planned anything and not give it a second thought, who have then come out of it blissfully absent of disappointment?
And
no, I don't think I have, honestly. No,
I think you do get people who don't plan anything and they do have incredibly positive births, and that is absolutely possible. Absolutely possible. But I don't think the best way to avoid disappointment is
to not think about it.
Not think about it. In a sense. It's not really a guarantee. I'm really conscious.
All I was just add then, it isn't the kind of, they might not come away disappointed because it's like they didn't care, they were going with the flow anyway. But what the issue for me, which I find, is when they find out things later which shouldn't have happened or whatever, that then triggers the disappointment usually. Even if they come away going, well, it had to happen, blah, 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 then they find something else that didn't have to happen, you go, well, what the hell? And then that's when that trauma and disappointment can really sit in. And that's ultimately what we're saying, isn't it?
And that's the vicious cycle, isn't it? You don't know what you don't know. And until you know that you need to know it, it's not ignorance. It's literally not realising that is there to know. Yeah. I'm really conscious of time. And I think going into this, what I'm about to say now is in a lot of depth, is yet another podcast episode. But Anna, in your experience and knowledge about cesarean, if you were to give top three tips for somebody after a cesarean, so in recovery, regardless of what led to that cesarean, planned, unplanned, emergency, what would you say are the top three things that people should be aware of or set in place for their recovery beyond?
Yeah, absolutely. So number one, I would say, is bringing some level of movement back, probably more quickly than you might think, actually. Okay. So and that can be as simple as, so once you've moved from the recovery room onto, either you get a separate room or you're on the postnatal ward, rolling your wrists and rolling your ankles. So just bringing some level of circulation back, that can happen really quite quickly. And actually probably getting up and shuffling around a little bit. Now, bearing in mind that because incision through, not actually through your abdominal muscles, because that's a vertical incision at that point, or a vertical separation, so they're not cutting across muscular tissue, but your core has been through a hell of a lot. So in terms of just to ease that movement, so rather than trying to, I'm sorry, this is helpful for a podcast, but I'm mimicking sitting up, rather than getting straight up, turning to your side, putting one hand down, and then kind of creating, sort of using your hand to push yourself up. You might have also seen, and this might be more tricky in hospital, but if you could find a way to either put a towel or a scarf on and wrap it around the end of the bed, and then you could actually, as a pulley system almost, to be able to pull yourself up, then definitely take some slippers that you can just shove your feet into, or slides and socks, because sometimes your feet can feel really cold afterwards. And then a little bit of just very gentle unfurling of your core, and then just a bit of movement around. That can make a huge difference early. So just getting some movement back.
Is that comparable to, say, when people are during pregnancy have got really severe, say, pelvic girdle pain or SPD, where you're trying not to sit yourself up, you're trying to roll over and swing your legs down, and being really gentle on that area?
Exactly,
of body.
Yeah. So the swinging the legs down was the bit I forgot. Absolutely. So yes, definitely that. So that's number one.
Yep.
Secondly, the food you are probably, if you, so if you planned cesarean, you are going to be nil by mouth for some time before. If it's an unplanned, it's possible that you've been eating and drinking in labour, although you may have been stopped if they were sort of reading between the lines and prepping you for a cesarean. But anyway, regardless, the food that you have, ideally, nothing that's going to be too dry and that can make you cough could get caught in your throat. So people often go to sort of OT type bars and things like that. And honestly, I wouldn't recommend it. I would try and select something that's kind of like sort of soft or easy to that, that's just not going to potentially get caught. If that does, I would, so certainly I would recommend everyone takes their own pillow to hospital anyway. But if you were to then place your pillow over the scar to kind of brace it a bit, if you do have to cough or laugh, say you've got a hilarious birth partner, against just a brace against the core, that can really ease with that. Now, the chances are that you probably are going to have quite a lot of pain relief at that point still anyway, but I do think that that's quite a good little tip there. So your hydration, maybe probably nothing too fizzy, too burpy, chewing gum on that. That would be my next tip. Having chewing gum can really help to ease painful trapped wind, which is one of the side effects that we don't really talk about very much after a cesarean, which can be bloody painful. Sort of pain in kind of the shoulder blades, the ribs, kind of just getting caught in other parts of the body. And there was a Cochrane review, would you believe, on chewing gum being one of the cheapest and easiest ways to ease gas in the body. Peppermint tea, licorice tea would also do the trick, but chewing, it's the act of chewing, I think, that helps.
Okay.
That's a great
that's a tip that I always share, but I hadn't really considered it. Obviously, I was thinking more like digestively. I wasn't thinking about where it moves around the body, but that makes total sense, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be nowhere near the incision. It's a completely different part of the body. So, yeah, so it's a funny thing that. But that can really help with these. And then a bonus one I would also say that I can think can be really helpful is bringing back some level of scar desensitization really quite quickly. I'm literally looking around my desk now and finding different... Oh, something's going on here I don't know about as I'm just chatting.
Carry on. I'm gonna mute my dog. My dog has just come back from doggy daycare, so he's just
love it. I don't have a dog yet, but that's another podcast.
It's not me making probably. These noises.
Sorry. So being scar desensitization, if you can find some things around your house that you could take, so really basic for your finger to start with, not on the incision, but over and above. I'm not saying necessarily straight in hospital, and maybe this is like the day that you go a couple of days later, but just to be aware of this, a little bit of rubbing your finger just above for 30 seconds or something, sort of wiggling it above the incision, a Q-tip, a clean makeup brush, I don't know, a sponge, a leaf, whatever. Different textures can just start to bring back that sensation.
From what point would you suggest doing that?
Oh, you could do that a couple of days in. I mean, yeah, really, if that, like, you could, I think doing it in hospital is probably a little bit much, depending how long you're there for, you know, because you can, generally, people are being, if they're all, everything's fine, within 24 hours, which is extraordinary. Yeah. But if there are, if perhaps gestational diabetes, they're looking at the baby's sugar levels or whatever, and you're there for a few days. But really, quite quickly, you can bring back that level of scar desensitization, because there are people walking around with numb scar years after, you know, and that...
Yeah.
Is the thing, I think. And then maybe sort of thinking about compression wear. I mean, God, there's so many things to talk about.
I said three, Anna.
It's me. I can never tap
it's too much knowledge. It's brimming over.
No, never. It's that just flows out me like lava. But anyway.
we're talking about geology now. Brilliant.
Yeah, that's you. So, but no, I'd say the three definitely are movement quite quickly, chewing gum for sure, and then nothing's going to get caught in your throat. Those would be my first three ones. Can I have one bonus one? Sorry.
Go on.
Journey home, because we don't think about this. So if the person driving you home, this is the bit that can be really intense. If you are taking a route that's got potholes, for example, you want to tell your person you need to be in a car with really great suspension for a start. So maybe that's a black cab. I'm not sure. Maybe you get bounced around in those a bit. Sorry, I know it's very London-centric. Again, placing maybe a maternity pad, sticky side out, over your incision, then your pillow, then your seatbelt, and disperse that pressure. And then take, so whoever's driving, really slow, very smooth journey home, because that's intense.
I mean, I've not had a cesarean either, but that's exactly what I did when I drove home from the hospital last week. I had well, to be fair, actually, they didn't even put anything over mine because it was glued. But equally, I just had my pyjama top because I wanted something loose over it.
Yes.
And then I had a pillow. And then, and even still then, I was holding my boob like, ah, because any little movement.
Oh, God,
so
yeah.
I know I've not had that cesarean, but I can definitely empathise with that scar kind of tissue feeling on that journey home, 100%. Oh, yeah. I can't agree more.
Leads us nicely, Leanne, into, I would imagine people will be incredibly sympathetic towards you and your recovery. And you mentioned on social media the day that not long after your surgery, you'd done a really gentle yoga class and they'd been really supportive. The people who'd been in the class helping you take stuff to your car. Mm. And that when people have had surgery, we support them and we nurture them and we allow them to recover and we're incredibly sympathetic, except for when somebody has cesarean surgery.
I know.
And the expectation from themselves, I think, as well, yeah, but from those around them, that they haven't just had a major, major abdominal surgery and are expected to be kind of just up and about. And I know you talked about movement, but...
yeah.
You know, we really need to, if I can add an extra postnatal recovery thing, is really build in a network of support. Who is going to feed you and water you? Who is going to pass the baby to you? Where are you going to sit or lie? Who is going to help you go up the stairs? Who is going to do some cleaning for you? Because if you'd had abdominal surgery for any other reason or any other kind of surgery, you would have that in place and society would not deny you that. And I'm not saying people are denying new parents a recovery element, but come on, you know.
Oh, it's absolutely wild. You think work. I mean, it is just mad. And then you've got a whole new job of looking after a baby. Yeah. You know, and if it's not a first, you've potentially got other kids in the mix.
Lift anything heavy, but yet you've got it's
crazy. So
yeah, I can't lift more than 2.5 kilograms. And I was talking to a client, she was like, yeah, neither could I on a cesarean, 6 weeks. I was like, I mean, I'm struggling.
And also the isolation, you can't drive. So if a partner, if there is a partner with you and they're maybe going back to work, and the isolation that comes from, particularly coming where, so being out of London, up here, I'm up north where, you know, it's all horse and carts and stuff. if you don't have your own transport, you are really isolated in general.
Yes.
And so that isolation, which can happen in parenthood anyway, I think is really compounded by a cesarean recovery because you just can't get about and do what you otherwise would have been doing.
Yeah, it's a huge consideration. So there's a really great book. Hold it up
to hand. Look at this.
Why Postnatal Recovery Matters.
I love that. It's just here. It's just on my shelf. Anna is now demonstrating.
There you go, on a screen that anyone listening can't see, but it's really great. And her four tenets of postnatal recovery are rest, social support, nutrition, and body work. And you can absolutely apply those more specifically to a cesarean, but rest is king. I mean, there's no question about that. Finding out if you're breastfeeding, side-lying feeding, rugby hold feeding, all these sorts of things. So getting support in place for that. So important. And we just don't, who are you going to find who is going to help you to do that? It's just really, really important.
And sort it now. Don't just go, I'll ask if I need support. Like, who are they now?
Too late. I mean, not to, obviously, you can do stuff, but it's just having that set in place is going to make a huge, huge difference afterwards. And, you know, and if we're talking about people planning for a cesarean, you know, I guess you should plan postpartum belt and braces with that with that in mind, I guess, is the thing. Yeah. But we don't really. We don't. And, you know, that mythical village that come round and help. So.
When are they here? Where's the village coming?
How do I find them?
Thank you so much, Anna. I know we've gone really over in this, but it's such incredible, valuable knowledge for everybody. And I really hope that anybody who has listened to all of this who is really not, their ideal birth is not a cesarean, I hope that they have really had food for thought and are motivated to, even if they're not motivated to create a document that they're motivated to just look a little bit more into it and take some of this on board, and importantly communicate it to their partner as well. Yeah, I think you've given so many things to think about.
No, pleasure. I could talk about it all day, obviously, but I won't. But the, I was supposed to pick up my daughter from school at some point. My son is ill in the other room, but that's another story. He's fine. he's watching Harry Potter, probably. Not plugging my wares, but what I would just say is if anyone does want to see a template for a cesarean birth, then I have one for free on my website. So if people want to go to that, then they're
What's your website?
hackneyhypnobirthing.com. And it's under the free stuff on there. And you it gives you a bit of an idea about, and it's editable, so there are seemingly contradictory things in there, and you just pick out what you want. And it just gives you a bit of, you know, a bit of a steer.
Awesome.
And what we could do is, with some suggestions from Anna and ourselves, is we'll put some links to some really good social media accounts in the description for this episode. So if you want to go, we've mentioned a few different people in the course of this episode, is we'll put little links to them so you can go and find their resources as well, because there is a world of stuff out there.
So professional, guys. Love it.
I know, right? Anyway, thank you so much for joining
us,
Anna.
Pleasure.
I mean, we'll see you on, like, we'll end the call and chat up in 20
minutes. Yeah, exactly, of course. Okay, lovely to be here.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Do La La. Don't forget to click like and share with all your friends.
Whoop, whoop.
Thanks for listening to Do La La, the podcast.
With me, Leanne from Birthhood. And me, Meg from Birth Evolution. It's been great to have you here with us as we chat about all things pregnancy, birth and postnatal.
We'd love to know what you think, so please do leave us a review. Follow both Meg and I on socials and share with your friends too. They'll be really glad you did.